Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everybody, and happy spring. This is Jackie Berger, and you're listening to Just Food Stories, airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. If you missed the live broadcast, you can always find us archived at heritageradionetwork.org or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just Food is a nonprofit organization committed to helping people build community food projects. We know that people all over New York City know that we need to change our food system and that they want to make that change, but so often people don't even know where to start. So we'd like to take the next half hour to introduce you to some people who, and this is our regular intro, we say started, but gosh, they've done so much more than start. They take their passion and skills to bring change, and hopefully their stories will help you, inspire you to create your own Just Food story. So we're in the studio today with two luminaries, and I am so, honestly, frankly, I'm dazzled by the two of you. We have Liz Newmark and Michelle Nishan in the studio with us today. Both of them are such incredible leaders in this movement. Liz is the CEO and founder of Great Performances, which is an incredible catering company and so much more here in New York City. She has started a farm, Kachke Farm, upstate. It's a 60-acre organic farm, and Kachke Farm is home to the Sylvia Center, which is a garden-to-table culinary-based program that inspires young people to discover good food and flavors on the farm and in the kitchen. Liz is involved in so many different nonprofits, supporting and leading them. She is an author of Sylvia's Table, which is a cookbook which just came out this past summer. I'm so grateful to have you here, Liz. And Michelle Nishan is in the studio with us. Also, Michelle Nishan also wears so many hats as the founder and owner of The Dressing Room, which is a homegrown restaurant in Westport, Connecticut, and president of Wholesome Wave, which is an incredible organization dedicated to nourishing neighborhoods by supporting increased production and access to healthy, fresh, and affordable locally grown food for the well-being of all. So, and another cookbook author with amazing books that you can find and read. So both of them, there's so much more to unpack here. And I'd love to take the next half hour to unearth your stories a little bit and to kind of get your history a little bit, because you've led such incredible lives, both in the kitchen and out, and used your place in the kitchen and in the food movement to really transform this movement for all of us. So this question is going to be for both of you. I can start with Liz because she's sitting right next to me. But how did food become your vocation? Because in some ways, we can say that that has, and you do so much more. But how did food, what was that moment that brought you into food?
Well, you know, I think growing up in a family where five people are expected for dinner and there's food for 30, you know, everything happens in your roots. You know, accidentally ended up in the food business after studying political science and urban studies at our mutual alma mater, Barnard. But, you know, it's interesting because I got into food through a back door, which is how many people do it. Mm-hmm. And fast forward three decades, I'm back in political science because I discovered not only my passion for food and life happening around food and catering and nurturing people, but the politics of food is probably the best politics I've been able to be involved with.
It's incredible that it's come full circle for you.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. And I want to talk about that lightning moment to you, too. But first, I want to hear from Michelle. How did food become your vocation? I know it started, I guess, when you were probably in the womb.
Yes, it did. Both of my parents were farmers who lost their land to the conventional ag takeover after World War II. But my grandfather held on to pieces of it. He kept selling pieces off to try to keep it alive. So I used to go down there and work every summer. I can't remember not being surrounded by good food and an awareness of where food comes from and that good food for my family was just a normal thing, even though they were relatively poor. When I had to leave home shortly after high school, my parents needed to downsize because they fell on hard times. Me and my older brother moved out so they could get a smaller house. We had a younger brother and sister. And my mom said, you can cook, get a job in a restaurant, at least you'll eat. So my whole life has been food, starting simple. But the interesting thing about the restaurant business, the moment for me was the first aha moment is like, wow, I'm really good at this, and all the chefs like me because I could really, I could dispatch a hog, I could, break it down, I could butcher, I could do all that
Being
stuff.
Being the farm boy,
knew
that
how
you
to braise,
were.
Knew how to roast, all of that jazz. Didn't call it sautéing. There was a language problem, but once I got that down, I was really surprised at the really poor quality of food that was coming in the back door of some of these restaurants that I was working with. And I said, boy, I'll just be a chef someday, and then I'll buy directly from farmers, and then I'll kick everybody's butt. Only to find out when I became a chef that there were no farmers left, and I had, the way that I raised that I thought was normal was gone. So that I immediately became an advocate from that point. So that was my aha moment where I actually felt that loving food was not enough, growing my own food and cooking food was not enough. I felt compelled to do something about it.
And that's something that both of you have had to wrestle with, struggle with in being owners and managers and chefs in the culinary world. How, Michelle, how did you have to transform the food system around you in order to do what you wanted to do in the kitchen?
It was wild. My first farm-to-table acquisition was in 1981. I was a chef at a restaurant called the Fleur-de-Lis in Milwaukee. I went out looking for farmers. There weren't any. I found one farmer.
I'm like picturing you kind of driving around in a truck, just kind of with your eyes.
Yeah, in whites. And people are like closing the door on me, and they're like, boy, are you weird. I'm like, this one young couple, looked at me because they were kind of my age, and they invited me in for coffee. The wife had inherited the farm from her parents, and she said, yeah, we used to grow vegetables when I was like 8 or 9, but I think my parents went with the soy and corn rotation
because
that's where the money is.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, the money's not there. But there's this patch of asparagus that migrated its way down to an access road. They sent me back there and said, take all you want. But it was my only farm-to-table acquisition that year.
Unbelievable.
So, I know you've gone through this too, Liz, especially at the scale that you guys do business. It's like you make 50 phone calls. Back then, I would make 50 phone calls and do driving around to have like 5% of my cooler come from directly from a farmer. And thank God that's changed.
Well, and I know that your story, Liz, will be very different. I mean, being here in New York City, that you can't really tell us about what happened when you really start to make that push for local food in the kitchen.
Well, what's really interesting is because in the catering world, we respond to, we educate clients, but we are directed by a lot of their wishes. And not that long ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, the tagline that we were all so proud of was that, we source our food from, the dark side of the moon, if that's where you want it from.
Yeah, right. People were like, I got the raspberries from Chile.
Yeah.
And it was crazy because nothing was too far, nothing was too exotic, and that was the badge of honor.
Yeah, this weird spice, this exotic flavor, this unusual fruit, that was what you were finding.
You could defy the seasons, like peonies in February. It was just bizarre. And it didn't, the thing was, it didn't have a lot of taste.
Mm-mm.
And as we grew, I felt we're something's getting away from us. And I wanted to reconnect with flavor and taste, but passion.
Yeah.
I thought, let's think about farming. Because if we put our love into it, we're going to taste it on the plate. Mm. And a bunch of other, life-changing moments, doesn't happen easily. And so we're at a very, very large scale of production. But over the years, not only from our own farm, but really, more importantly, developing this network, working with, these concepts now that are de rigueur, talking about hubs and buying from other farmers. And we're at a point now in Hudson Valley. We have great relationships, and there's wonderful access. It's come 180 degrees.
So having a farm and having that base in farm country, you've been able to make other connections and to source the farm produce that you've wanted that way.
Yes. And, you know, when you hear Michelle and his story and you're talking about the farm and you have that connection to the land, that's the critical piece no one quite realizes. Because when you have that relationship with the farmer, with the earth, when you look at the weather and everybody's complaining because it's raining and you're saying, no, it's great, we need
<It's>
rain.
<awesome. laughs>
You know, the farmers love rain. You look at life differently.
Yeah.
And that we impart to my colleagues, and then in turn we send that out to our clients, and you know, you fall in love with food a different way, and
totally.
That's an educational path.
And I'm glad you mentioned education, because I feel like it's such a tricky road that so many chefs and food business owners need to wrestle with. How do you educate? Where do you educate? When do you educate? And I feel like, Michelle, at the dressing room, you've really bravely gone where few chefs will go in terms of food education. And I know that now you've shifted focus, but
yeah, we've done some wacky stuff. I am now a reformed restaurateur. We did close dressing room.
Yes, I know.
On New Year's Eve, because Wholesome Wave is just so. It's way too compelling and way too many things going on. We're growing way too fast. So, but to some of the things that we did at Dressing Room that I particularly dug when we stumbled across, you know, Kathleen Harris and Annie Farrell from Millstone Farm introduced us to Kathleen, who aggregates animals from small scale producers and gets them to slaughter facilities. And when we learned that there was this guy, David Hughes, the late David Hughes of Stonebrook Farm, which is still there, had grass-fed Devon, and we could get all of our beef from one person.
Mm-hmm.
The trick was how do we not have steak on the menu? So we're buying from Heritage Foods and filling in from Nyman Ranch, things like that, being as sustainable with our beef program as we could. But we always had a steak on the menu because that's expected. If we really wanted to do the thing where we bought like all of our beef from one guy,
yeah,
we couldn't have steak on the menu because it's less than 10% of the animal. So we took the route of telling people stories about David, who was the wackiest, most wonderful guy, and his beautiful red Devon, and how he used to actually move the animals to grass in the wintertime because it used less fossil fuel to move animals to the food than the many, many tons of food to the animals. It really, and just the breed, and you know why we don't have steak on the menu, we'd say, you know, it's less than 10% of the animal. So but what's cool about it is when we do run it as a special, if you're having the steak and someone next to you is having the pot roast and someone's having a burger and someone's having the meatloaf, it all came from the same animal,
the whole cow,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'd do little sidebars on our menu and people are like, that's so cool. Kind of like a did you know? I didn't know that steak was only, they look at those pictures of the cow and see all of those little dotted lines and the different, and they think the whole thing is steak.
Yeah.
Right? And then it changes the way they think. Because then they would like go out and see Food Inc. and then come back and hug us and stuff.
Right.
Because they're like, thanks for not beating us over the head, but I felt so equipped to deal with that because you guys are like presenting a solution, you know?
And I think it's so great because both of you as chefs, as business owners, and now as nonprofit leaders also, but in your roles as chefs and business owners, you had the opportunity to educate so many people and bring so many people into this movement. But then even as the very busy people that you were running restaurants, running catering businesses, you also something was triggered in you where it was no longer enough, where you had to move from what you were doing to you have to do more. What was that moment for you, Michelle? Because I know it was a long time ago, but what was that moment that triggered that you needed to do more?
Yeah, immediately when I became a chef, I needed to buy from local producers and try to reestablish, you know, just the system of values that lives in farming culture, you know, that the one that like spiritual connection to the land, but also the neighborliness, the family values. I mean, you talk about those things. It's popular language on the far right, but it's they're not talking about it in very meaningful ways. You know, somebody in the community's house burns down in a farming community, and one family takes the boys, another family takes the girls. We have clothes that fit. They can use our truck. In most of America today, if someone's house burns down in the neighborhood, you say, "Oh, I hope they have good insurance." Right. so that farming culture thing I wanted to restore. But about 19 years ago, almost 20 years ago, my son Chris, when he was 5 years old, was diagnosed with diabetes. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that my wife Lori and I learned was that what we did with Chris's food would have more to do with the quality of his long-term outcome than anything, because he'll have it all of his life. There is no reversing type 1. Mm-hmm. And then I started learning about type 2. So I changed everything. I did Heartbeat Restaurant. I closed the restaurant I had in Connecticut. I partnered with Drew Nieporn. We did a restaurant of well-being, local, organic, sustainable, but no processed foods of any kind. We opened in 1998. Mm. And a few years through there, I went to a symposium on diabetes with Harvard School of Public Health and other folks. And somebody really spoke about how, you know, I'm learning that it's preventable through diet, mm-hmm. reversible in early stages through diet, mm-hmm. and mitigatable, even if you're in advanced stages, that food can have a tremendous healing impact and prevent some of the horrible, you know, aftermaths of having the disease, and that most of the people that suffer from it are so poor they can't afford good food. Mm-hmm. So that was the railroad tie to the side of my head. I was patting myself on the back, charging people $50 for an entree, feeling good about putting local healthy food on the table.
Which is good, but...
Yeah, it is good. But then that tens of millions of Americans are suffering from something like type 2 diabetes, and the thing that they need most to either prevent it or reverse it or give their families a chance not to have to face this horrible disease, they can't afford to buy the food that can help them do that. So that's the impetus that led to the formation of Wholesome Wave.
And I'm going to get back to that in just a minute. But I want us to also hear from you, Liz, as somebody who was running this growing empire of bringing food to the masses of New York City. I mean, she was the food empire in Empire City. So how did you find, what was the thing that pushed you to do more?
Little empire.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful empire.
It's great. You know, I always say that when something important happens in New York, the president comes to town, or diplomats, or launching a new movie, a product, whatever, we're always part of it, and that's great. But I guess what happened for me is, you know, my clients are very demanding, very, very, very privileged. And it really is a small percentage of New York, and you can get really caught up with it. In 2004, my youngest child, Sylvia, died suddenly right before her 7th birthday. And, you know, that's a whole nother story, but trying to figure out how do I go back to this world of the rarefied, privileged few and focus on some of the very obscure details that one has to. And I thought I've got to find another way back. And in those days, I was a CSA junkie, and I would go to the farms to pick up my vegetables. I'd go to the green market, and I found it was the only place I felt whole. You know, there was just something about it. And I mm-hmm. woke up one morning, and I turned to my husband. I said, you know, this farm I've been talking about for years, we're going to buy the farm. Mm-hmm. The farm's going to be home to the Sylvia Center. And Sylvia Center would be a legacy for my daughter. It would be a way to be able to talk about her, say her name in a joyful, celebratory way, create a legacy that she would have done for herself because she was intent on being a helpful human. And as it grew and our mission grew, I realized, you know what? It's really satisfying in a very, very deep way to be looking at New York, but all New Yorkers. Mm. So my privileged clients and the underprivileged, and bringing them together. You know, we think so much about the fracturing of our society. Well, you know, in our world, at GP, Great Performances, you know, we have the ability to bring these two together. And that was the impetus.
That's awesome.
I love it. We are going to have to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Just Food Stories on heritageradionetwork.org.
Well, Miss Louise, can't you understand? Well, Miss Louise, I can't be a man. I'm a little too young, you a little too old. So get back, get back, get back your broken heart. Well, Miss Louise, why can't you see? Well, Miss Louise, this could never be.
Today's music is by the California Honey Drops on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
Welcome back. I'm Jackie Berger, and you're listening to Just Food Stories on HeritageRadioNetwork.org, and we're here with Liz Newmark and Michelle Nishan talking about how chefs and restaurant owners can move beyond farm to table in order to transform the food system. And both of you are doing that in a really big way. So, Michelle, before the break, you mentioned that you made the decision to close down the Dressing Room, a beloved restaurant. I'm sure that there were near riots when you decided to close
the
doors.
We're still getting all kinds of poop about that.
I bet. But you did it because you needed to focus. And so tell us, because I'm not sure that everybody knows, although everybody certainly should know about what Wholesome Wave has been and has done and is doing, but tell us a little bit about Wholesome Wave.
So we founded Wholesome Wave convinced that there had to be a way to allow citizens of poverty, urban and rural, multi-ethnicities, to do what we knew, what we felt at Wholesome Wave they wanted to do, and that's give their families the best chance at a long-term outcome and feed them better, and that a lot of these families actually know they should be and know how to feed their families better. They just can't afford to make the choice. So we took very simple, almost restaurateur-style approaches to prove it. At the last farm bill, there was a lot of energy to restrict SNAP or food stamps to be spent only on healthy food, which would have been a catastrophe, because in most communities where people don't have the wealth to have a car, that food doesn't exist. Then they get no food, right?
Right.
So we felt the best way to prove that people actually did want, there was demand, was run a two-for-one sale. We all know why the crappy food is cheap.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to level the playing field is to make the expensive food less expensive. So it was two for one fruit and vegetable sale in three states. Other partners came on board. We're now in like 26 states.
And I just want to put in a thank you because you're here in New York City supporting Just Food CSA program and allowing us to match when people pay with SNAP to belong to a CSA, we get to match it so that it really makes it so affordable for CSA members.
It's awesome. And what we saw, we were able to prove because we study the consumer outlook that people in poverty, the number one quality attribute, the number one reason of importance of the program to them is quality of produce.
Mm.
And then number two is supporting local farmers and businesses tied with the market accepting SNAP benefits. So, and then we were able to prove that, you know, farmers put more land in production, added, you know, made infrastructural investments, added jobs, diversified their crop planting, etc. So, you know, we're very instrumental in getting language in the farm bill now for $100 million to fund fruit and vegetable incentives at farmers markets and farm to retail.
It's one of the only good stories coming out of this farm bill, but it's a really good story.
Yeah, so, you know, we just, to me, you know, I feel like I felt like when I was a young chef, you know, making some decisions that have a really great outcome and feeling really good about it. I think dressing room is great, but I think there are so many amazing chefs and so many talented culinarians now really supporting local food systems and economies and all that good jazz. I think the dam is broken, and we're going to see it grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. But I am now all about Wholesome Wave all the time.
And it's so great that you, because you guys are making huge change. Liz, tell us about the Sylvia Center. What it has grown over the years, and tell us about where you are now with the program.
Absolutely. It's a bifurcated program, so half of our kids come to visit us up at the farm, and the other half are in the city. At the farm, it's a day-long program where they come, they walk through fields. Half of the kids come from more urban areas, and half of them come from the neighborhood, mm-hmm. the capital region, Hudson, and they are, 3, 4, 5 miles away from a farm, and they've never been to a farm.
Right.
So they come, they walk through the fields. We have a 2-acre children's garden where they plant, they harvest, and then they cook together in our open air, we call it the field house. We do have a fabulous pizza oven there too. And for many of them, they're learning skills they've never used before. Mm-hmm. They've never cooked in a community, and then they eat together, which is something that, you know, we take it so for granted, but it doesn't really happen a lot of times in these kids' lives.
So, and it's just a transformational experience. I mean, what have you seen? How have you seen kids come out of that changed?
Well, I've seen kids who swear they're not going to touch spinach or beets or radishes or, you know, try some of the nibble things in the garden, and they come out and they say, oh my God, it was so good. I want the recipe. And then the other half the time we work in the city, in New York City public, in NYCHA housing, mm-hmm. community centers, New York City Housing Authority, where we work with our kids for 6 weeks, twice a week. So it's much more intensive.
It's a really intensive program.
Amazing. But I will say we shop in those communities for the food. So mm-hmm. we like to talk about seasonality, but you know what? If we're going to get on some high horse about seasonality and local, and they don't have access to it, really, what's the point?
We got to link your program so that the markets that are being supported by Wholesome Wave are accessible to the NYCHA housing.
I love it.
Kids.
We should.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think it was 2010, USDA was coming out with their farmers market census, and they had to stop because they thought there were like 6,000 and there were 7,100. And the reason why they miscounted is because many of those markets had come online in underserved communities, were not part of like the farmers market coalition.
Mm-hmm.
They were just off the radar. And a lot of it was because of the explosive movement to get SNAP into farmers markets, incentive programs all over the country. A lot of those markets that they weren't counting were markets that we were doing our programs. And so what we are seeing as a result now, and we're very hopeful with the SNAP dollars and our fruit and vegetable prescription program, is actually aiming at the Affordable Care Act to steer even more dollars into these communities so these food businesses can pop up. It's a hell of a lot easier to get a 4-6 vendor market to go into a food desert area. I hate that term, but everybody understands what it means. So it's a lot easier to get a small market to go and then dig the $5 million grocery store shovel in the ground. We have about 30,000 food deserts. So,
Then we pick up where you leave off, because what's happened in these communities is you get the butternut squash or some sort of green, and you know what?
You're like, what the hell do
Nobody
I do with that?
Nobody knows what to do with it. Right. So how can you make intelligent choices about what you're going to eat if you don't know how to prepare food?
Yeah, amen.
So I'm so glad I'm so glad we have both halves of the circle here. And
indeed.
And I feel like we have only just scratched the surface, but a half an hour goes so quickly. But if you are still hungry for more, then I hope you will come and see and hear these two folks at the Just Food Conference, April 5th and 6th. There'll be at a chef on two of our panelists on a featured panel from Farm to Table and Beyond, chefs and their communities. So you will have a chance to hear more from both Liz and Michelle. Thank you both so much for being with me today.
You're welcome, Jackie.
A pleasure. We'll bring some spinach, okay?
Yes.
Pass out to anybody who comes.
That would be great.
Succulente.
And so I want to thank Liz and Michelle, Evan DeVito for engineering today's show. Hopefully these stories will inspire you to create your own Just Food story. You can always find archived episodes on Just Food Stories on heritageradionetwork.org and as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And remember, if you have any questions for the program, you can call in live at 718-497-2128 or email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. See you next week, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. California honey drop.